If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In September 1666, a devastating blaze swept through England's capital, in a catastrophic event that was to have a lasting impact on the city and its people. In today's episode, we're talking about the Great Fire of London with historian Rebecca Radil. Putting your questions to Rebecca, along with popular internet search queries, was BBC History Revealed editor Charlotte Hodgman.
The first thing to kind of know, I guess, is kind of how did the fire start?
The fire started. This is the one part that everyone knows, to be perfectly honest. We know that the fire started in Thomas Farriner's bakehouse in the early hours of Sunday morning on September the 2nd, 1666. And from there, it spread. So it absolutely started there. But obviously, if you'd been alive and wandering around the city at that time of night, probably not that time of night, actually, but maybe in the early morning, there were lots of rumours about where it had actually started. And people were, tapping into pre-existing xenophobic feeling to blame foreigners in inverted commas. But we do know it started in Thomas Farriner's bakehouse.
So one of the questions, a popular question that we were being asked, and this is from somebody called Today's Rewind on Twitter, wants to know, how long did the fire last?
The easy answer is to say that it lasted for around 4.5 days. So it broke out in the early hours of Sunday morning, ended roughly around Thursday. But what I want to caveat that with is the fact that for weeks and weeks, and actually some months afterwards, when people were wandering around the city, the ruins of the city, it was still smouldering. There was still smoke there for a long time. So the short answer, 4.5 days, long answer, well, it could have been a couple of months.
Gosh. Screaming Croissant on Twitter wanted to know, what's considered our best approximation of the actual death toll?
What I always say with this question is that if anyone gives you a straight answer, then don't trust it, because we cannot know. It's something that we literally cannot know. At the time, or, you know, a couple of years later, there were suggestions and quotes and thoughts leading to a low figure, a low death toll, around 6 or 8, sometimes 12 people to have perished during the Great Fire of London. But I think there are a lot of things that haven't been accounted for. So people that were having to take refuge on Moorfields, for example, during the Great Fire, I think a lot of people would have suffered the effects of the fire and destitution and probably perished much sooner than they would have done ordinarily. But equally, going into the parish burial records, which I have done, you find interesting shifts in the way that, well, the types of deaths that are reported. So usually you'd expect to find a significant number of infant deaths in parish burial records. And in some parishes, these are completely absent. Now, why? I mean, why would they be absent? In other records, the mean age of death shoots up and it becomes a much higher, people are dying at a much older age. So there's interesting patterns going on. There are accounts of, people being found in locations like the writer William Taswell, for example, who was a schoolboy during the time of the Great Fire, notes how he saw the remains of an old woman in St. Paul's Cathedral who'd perished during the fire as well. So I wouldn't like to give a figure. One thing that I often say, though, is in terms of size, impact, and time of year, and the makeup of the city, weirdly, the Great Fire of Chicago is actually a very useful parallel. It was a fairly wooden city when it broke out in 1871, I believe it was. And they had a much better handle on the population and the number of people who died. And during the Great Fire of Chicago, we think that around 300 people died. So while I wouldn't like to say, yes, it was in the hundreds during the Great Fire of London, I think it's a useful way to think about things, perhaps.
Why did the, how did the fire spread so quickly?
It was a perfect combination of factors, really. So the London during the year 1666 had enjoyed a really warm, dry summer. And this was towards the tail end of it. And because the city was very wooden, lots of, most of the buildings in the city of London, so this is the historic walled section of London, were made out of wood. So they dried out, they'd become essentially tinder. So you've got those two things, the dry summer, the fact that the city's a tinderbox, but then also you have the really strong easterly wind that blows the fire once it starts westward, I should say. And then you have the fact that the fire broke out during the early hours of a Sunday morning when everybody would have been in bed. It's much quieter. This is a time where people stick much more rigidly to working patterns, and the Sunday is still sacrosanct. So people wouldn't be out and about as much as they would be on any other day of the week. So these variety of factors all combined to ensure that when the Great Fire started, it spread really quickly and was able to really take a hold of the historic city.
Charlotte Sikorsky on Instagram wants to know how great was the fire in relation to other fires that had occurred in London?
Yeah, pretty great in a kind of large sense. Not great. I mean, it wasn't fun.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, often we use these words like great this, great that, and great the other. So the Great Plague of the previous year, for example, was great in terms of the death toll. Like, more people died during that outbreak of plague than had done during previous outbreaks in the 17th century, but proportionally, perhaps earlier plagues may have been more deadly. So the term great is often problematic, but this was a great fire. There had been huge fires in London before. London Bridge had sections of it burning, and one section was actually quite useful during the Great Fire because it's arguable that it may have prevented it spreading. It created a firebreak that prevented the fire spreading over to Southwark. So yes, this was a large fire by comparison to other fires that had happened in the city.
Abigail Maron asks, "What do we know what sort of temperatures the fire would have reached kind of at its peak?"
Interestingly, we do actually. So there was archaeological excavations in certain sections of the city of London a few decades ago. And from those archaeological discoveries, researchers were able to point to the fire reaching 1700 degrees Celsius, which is extraordinarily hot.
Yeah.
But we also get accounts, eyewitness accounts from the time that point to metal melting. And I mean, for that to happen, the temperatures would have had to have been incredibly high. And people talk about looking, you know, if they face the fire, the direction of the fire, they can feel the heat on their face. And there are cats that one cat in particular that Samuel Pepys spots after the Great Fire, and all its fur has been singed off. So it was an incredibly hot fire.
One of the sort of common things that people talk about when it comes to the Great Fire is its impact on the, you talked about the plague of the previous year. So maybe we've had quite a few questions asking, did it actually end the plague of that previous year? Did it have any impact on that?
No, the plague from the previous year was already on its way out, and the number of plague deaths had been dwindling. So the plague had kind of fallen probably around March time, 1666. I mean, plague was endemic in the country, so there were still a few plague deaths happening. And in actual fact, when you look at the burial records from the week and the week after the Great Fire of London, you can see a couple of plague deaths there. But it wasn't as a consequence of the Great Fire that the Great Plague ended. It was already ending.
The rather aptly named Breadcrumbs wants to know, do we know much about the actual bakery itself? What it looked like? You mentioned that that's where the fire started. What do we know about the bakery and the baker?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So we know that there was a bakehouse. So it was on Pudding Lane, but it was in a little kind of enclave on Pudding Lane. And there was a bakehouse, and then there would have been the house that Farriner and his family lived in. So it was in this bakehouse that the fire started. His household, he was living with a couple of his kids, but also a maid. And the maid sadly perished she was the first victim of the Great Fire of London. Yeah, we know that. We know that Thomas Farriner, interestingly, I found that Thomas Farriner had been, as a kid, sent to Bridewell Prison, which was a kind of house of correction for children at that time and different, you know, waifs and strays. So it was also a place where patrons would often find apprentices and set young boys up on a career path. And I think that's what happened with Thomas Farriner. The fact that he was found wandering around the city in 1627, was sent to the House of Correction a couple of times, and then shortly after was apprenticed as a baker. So we know a bit about his life from that. And we also know that he was supplying quote unquote ship's biscuit to the Navy as well. So he had a good contract with the Navy at the time that the Great Fire broke out, and the right. Navy at that time was at war, so it would have been fairly lucrative for him.
Yeah, actually Lauren Mullaney on Facebook was wondering what happened to Thomas after the Great Fire of London.
Precious little, actually. He did get away. I mean, it was an accident. No, you know, he didn't start this fire on purpose, but his bakehouse was to blame. And he was fine. He didn't, I mean, people kind of knew that there was a kind of cognitive dissonance that was going on. They knew logically that the fire had started at Thomas Farriner's bakehouse, but equally they wanted to blame Catholics as well. So they had those two things going on in their mind. He died in 1670. His children were actually signed the bill that prosecuted the man that was used as a scapegoat and was officially blamed for the Great Fire.
Okay, yeah, we'll come on to the suspects in a minute. Hannah Laura Ridgely wanted to know, was there any organised fire service in place that was there to tackle the fire?
So there were fire engines that existed, but they were more, just to give a little description of them, so they were kind of like a cart with wheels and a bucket with a pump on the top. The bucket would obviously be filled with water, and then the pump would be used to squirt this water up at the affected areas. So they tried to get one of these fire engines up towards Pudding Lane pretty early on, but it was just too cumbersome. And the roads in London at this time, the streets and lanes, were all just far too narrow for these things to be effective. Other things that they did to try and prevent fire was using water squirts, which were handheld things. They'd have like picks that would be used to pull down certain parts of buildings. But then the main and most effective approach to a fire that was seen to be quite, you know, growing quite significantly was to create fire breaks. And that would basically be just pulling down surrounding houses and buildings to prevent the fire spreading any further. So that's essentially what was going on. In terms of organisation, it fell to the jurisdiction of London, specifically the City of London and a few out parishes as well, fell under the control of the Lord Mayor and the City Alderman as well. So it was kind of at one remove from the royal family and royal control. That said, the royals could step in and take over, but it was, there was always a bit of friction between Whitehall and the City of London. That's a whole other topic, but just so you know, that was there. So anyway, the control for organising the fight against the fire should have fallen to the Lord Mayor and the aldermen and the various parishes. But for various reasons, namely the Lord Mayor that was there at the time, this didn't happen effectively. So the job of tackling the fire was given to Charles II's brother, James the Duke of York, who would later be James II. And he organised teams of men to tackle the fire at various points around the city. And he would, he was encouraging people to be involved, volunteers to be involved with bread and beer. I mean, I say beer, it's not like they were getting drunk and having a jolly good time. Beer was the easiest and safest drink to have at that point in time in terms of, it wasn't bad for the body in ways that water might have been. So these teams were set up all around the city to tackle various parts. So a key location in the fight against the fire was near the Fleet River, because the Fleet River separated essentially the City of London from the west part of London, and the west part of London that would lead to the palaces of governance, so Whitehall and Westminster as well. So no one wanted the fire to spread further than that. So that's, these teams were set up. There was also a team of schoolboys from Westminster School that were on the east side tackling the fire by the Tower of London. And they had, overall, they really didn't have that much effect because the winds were too strong. The fire was too full by the time that this concerted effort was brought in to fight it. But that's a that's a long answer to the question.
Bushy Beaton wants to know, was anybody actually ever taken to court and prosecuted over the fire?
So I just want to say, brilliant name. Congratulations, Bushy Beard Tom. Yes, someone was prosecuted. I kind of hinted at that before. So it was a French man named Robert Hubert, who was prosecuted. He had an alibi, though. He was actually away during the time of the Great Fire. He was at sea. Nevertheless, he confessed. I don't know why he confessed. No one quite knows why. We see historically sometimes people confess to things that they've not done. We can only guess as to his reasons why and his mental state when he was making this confession. But in any case, he did confess to it. It helped that it was a French man because it kind of played into this xenophobia that was going on at the time. Xenophobia against French people and Catholics more generally. Hubert wasn't actually a Catholic, he was a Protestant, but nevertheless, it didn't matter. The narrative was there and the narrative seemed to fit. And he was tried, convicted, and then executed in October 1666 for the Great Fire of London. Overall, Catholics were blamed, and we know that on the monument that was erected after the Great Fire of London, for a good while, it stated that the Catholics were to blame for the Great Fire. So there was a scapegoat, and it's a fairly sad story, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, was there an official parliamentary investigation into the fire after it kind of, had calmed down?
In terms of an investigation, not so much. They obviously wanted to get to the bottom. The priority was getting to the bottom of what to do afterwards in terms of how to recover this city. And that's where we get really interesting developments in terms of, and this, it can be quite boring actually, in terms of home ownership, landlords, tenants, who owned what bit and which bits of London. And you get the development of these, what would have come to be known as fire courts, which were phenomenally successful in mitigating what could have been quite a complex and messy and antagonistic time after the Great Fire. So that was the main priority, but then also how to rebuild this city and what to do to ensure that this kind of thing wouldn't happen again.
Were there any sort of conspiracy theories going around? You know, you mentioned that there was a lot of kind of xenophobia around, you know, and people being blamed for it. But were there any other sort of theories going around at the time? And how popular were those?
Plenty of conspiracy theories that mainly revolved around an imminent invasion by the French and the Dutch as well, because England was at war with the Dutch at this point in time over trade bases along the West African coast. But that's another story. So there were rumours. So obviously you have all these people that are displaced. You have thousands of people living in dire conditions on Moorfields and the surrounding areas around London. They're all starving. They're all not starving, but they're all very hungry. They're all incredibly sleep deprived. And all it takes is like the whiff of a little bit of rumour for it to spread and circulate and flow around. And these rumours were that there was going to be a Dutch and a French invasion, that they were coming to attack and they were basically on their way. And these rumours spread extraordinarily quickly, because you actually find just if a few days into the fire, you find reports of an imminent attack reaching, you know, various locations like Wiltshire and places. You find people commenting that, oh, you know, the Dutch are invading, the French are invading. So this was what was going on. And then you see, because of this fear, you see the darker side of the Great Fire of London. And this is what commentators at the time said, you know, when the fire erupted, but it also erupted something else in people's souls, which was anger, fear, and xenophobia. And this became violent in some instances. I won't go into the details of the violence, because it is quite disturbing. But needless to say, there were several attacks that have been noted in the records that would have been incredibly traumatic for those experiencing them, and was, you can see from the records, traumatic for those who witnessed them as well.
Keeping on this kind of the Dutch link here, Michael de Reuter on Twitter wanted to know whether anybody considered the link to the fire in Terschelling that had happened, that's in the Netherlands, that had happened three weeks earlier, I think it was. Was there any link? You might want to kind of perhaps explain a little bit around the actual that fire, if you can as well, just to put it in context.
Yeah, so Michael de Reuter, great name again, very appropriate for the time period, because he was, of course, a major player in the Anglo-Dutch Wars. He's probably the most celebrated Dutch naval hero, in inverted commas again, of all time. He's basically, to the Dutch, he's their Nelson. 3 weeks before the Great Fire of London, England was at war with the Dutch, and they'd organised to do a raid on a small area of the Netherlands. And this was orchestrated by a man named Robert Holmes, who was a really unsavoury figure from this period in time. He was a very angry, kind of hothead that just did what he wanted to do, caused maximum destruction with everything he did. And he raided a village, set it alight. England celebrated this as a great victory. There was even pamphlets and images of this. And the Dutch were appalled at what had happened. But then obviously the Great Fire of London happened shortly afterwards. So it was, and this kind of fed into the idea that the Dutch were invading, this idea that there was a retaliation for what had already happened, or in any case, it might have been some kind of karma. So yes, that was absolutely in people's minds as well,
and that would have been that would have been something that people in England would have known about. That news had come back by then about it all.
People in London would have known about it, right? Because every naval victory was celebrated with bonfires and grand processions throughout the city of London. Yeah. So it would be hard not to know about it. Whether people around England, you know, in general knew about it, because obviously this is, we're focusing on London. England was largely, even at this point, largely still an agrarian country. So, you know, whether they knew exactly what had happened during this attack, I don't know. It probably is quite unlikely that they would have known the particulars, but definitely people in London where the Great Fire happened would have known.
I mean, do you think there's anything in the kind of retaliation idea? Do we know how it started in the bakery? You know, could it have been arson?
I find it, yes, it would be very unlikely that it was arson. Although I have seen a couple of historians have made interesting comments about, so when the Great Fire started, it seemed to people on the ground that there were coordinated arson attacks in buildings that were, you know, some distance away. So they couldn't work it out in their heads why a building that was, you know, a good distance from the fire would suddenly set alight. So there have been conversations and arguments made that maybe this was just people being opportunistic, or, you know, thought, oh, you know, someone set something alight, let's join in and do something as well. I'm not convinced by that argument, because there are also accounts of huge flakes of debris spreading around in the air and floating down and landing on different places. And I feel that those seemingly unconnected eruptions of fire were actually connected to this debris that was going through the air.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
From his account, we get the human side of things. So we get stories of women in the streets after the Great Fire, putting big wads of sugar into barrels of beer that they found and drinking them. You get the descriptions of pigeons having their wings scorched. You get this description of a cat having its fur singed. So all of these human things we're really lucky to have from his diary.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Diana Patterson on Twitter was talking about the people made homeless by the fire. Do we know what happened to them? Do we have any evidence of, you know, who gave them food, clothing, or shelter, and you know, how was that organised?
We do know a bit about what happened to them during the fire and immediately after in particular. So there was a call out to neighbouring towns, villages, to help with food and sustenance, to help with them. And this arrived kind of piecemeal. It arrived. And then as things became increasingly more serious in terms of the numbers of people that were stranded, the Navy was brought in and donated canvases that would have been used for sails and various things to create tents for them to sleep in on these fields. And also ship's biscuit was diverted to the refugees as well. So they had that to eat as well. That said, people that were wandering around and, you know, seeing what was going on, people like John Evelyn, said that they weren't really touching the ship's biscuit, and they were still basically in need. But there were efforts that were being made, and then later on there were charitable donations that were given all across the country, charitable donations to the Great Fire of London. And to be honest, if you go into any old church, you'll probably find some link in the records to donations that were made to the Great Fire of London in 1666.
Yeah, I mean, was there any formal help given by the Crown or by Parliament?
Well, the formal help that was given was the Navy. Was obviously it was the biggest public sector body, if you, for want of a better phrase, at this time. So that was the way that they were given help. But also that afterwards there were guidelines that were put in place to help people in a way, but more help the city get itself back on its feet in terms of making everything more orderly and removing these makeshift shops and commercial premises that people had put together with basically the ruins of their old houses and their old businesses. So there were guidelines that were put in place as well.
Which actually brings me to the next question from at Woking SF History. I think it's a school history department. So they wanted to know how quickly was London rebuilt after the fire and to what extent did this stimulate economic growth and transform the lives of those who lived in these parts of London?
So London, I mean, the building project got underway really quickly. Within days, actually, you find that people were actually marking, putting out posts to mark out the various locations of the old areas of London that had been destroyed. And I think it's important to remember, and I always try to emphasise this if I'm giving a talk, that we often see these kind of aerial pictures of London after the Great Fire, where you can see the damage. You can see that, around 80% of the old city of London has been destroyed, and that a certain section of the west outside of the city walls has been destroyed as well. But we see it and you kind of assume that this is a flat space, when in actual fact this were, the city was in ruins. And I think if we kind of conjure up images that are more reminiscent of scenes from the Blitz in the 1940s, I think that might be more helpful in terms of how we visualise the city. So this was a city that took an enormous amount of effort to remove this debris, then rebuild, but they actually managed to do it very quickly. And part of the reason for this were the fire courts that they put in place that basically sorted out who owned which bit of London, who had a tenancy in that section of London, how big homes were before, what size they'd needed to be afterwards. So there was that was put in place. But then also there were guidelines in terms of how buildings needed to be rebuilt, that they needed to be clad at least in brick rather than with, made from wood, that there needed to be a certain amount of gap and space between the river and the houses to allow for access to water, places and businesses that created flames and fire and fumes needed to be moved out to certain other locations as well. But we do get a sense that by the 1670s, you are having thousands of buildings that are being, put back together again, and churches funding, individual funding for churches. So lots of people donated to certain churches to have them rebuilt as well. And they were underway too. So it's a fairly quick process. The big building, so obviously the biggest of all, St. Paul's Cathedral, took several decades to, and several monarchs actually, until that was completed. Christopher Wren actually saw the process throughout and which is quite remarkable really. In many ways, there was a quick recovery. In other ways, it took a little bit longer. The financial recovery was fairly swift because the businesses that were the kind of the beating heart of and the engine of economy in the city had managed to move most of their stuff outside to places that were a bit more safe.
What other famous landmarks in London were either destroyed or damaged by the fire?
Okay, well, I can go through them. So 13,000 houses were destroyed, 87 churches, 52 livery halls, and then the city gates of London. So the gates of Ludgate, Newgate and Aldersgate, they were severely damaged. The Guildhall, which is still in London today and it's still historic and predates the Great Fire, but that was damaged during the Great Fire quite badly. And the Custom House, that would have been a central part of the trade that was coming into London via the Thames, that was destroyed as well. St. Paul's Cathedral, we've already touched upon, was destroyed and then rebuilt. Probably one of the biggest casualties outside of St. Paul's Cathedral was a castle known as Baynard's Castle, which was completely ruined. And the Royal Exchange as well, that was destroyed with many of the statues. It was a kind of this grand gesture to commercial ventures, and that was destroyed. The only thing that, the only statue that remained intact from that actually was the statue of Thomas Gresham himself, who'd paid for the building of the Royal Exchange. But then we see that the cost was estimated, the cost of the damage was estimated to be around 10 million. And I should stress as well that of the 86 churches that were destroyed, only a certain number of them were actually rebuilt. It kind of reorganised the way that parishes were put together in the City of London. To be fair, there were probably too many churches anyway, but you don't want to get rid of them by, you know, a devastating fire.
It's quite extreme.
It kind of reduced that. So,
who actually, and this is a question that's come up as well on social media, was who paid for the rebuilding of London? Was it down to individuals to rebuild their houses or, landlords or what? Did they get any sort of funding?
There was a mixture of ways in which the city was rebuilt. So there was a tax on coal, which was used to rebuild the city. There were churches, they had charitable donors or they would organise their own schemes to, get money, basically. But then of the homes that were destroyed and the individual houses and businesses, that would fall to the individuals to kind of recover from that. And that's hard. I mean, imagine being hit by your building being destroyed, but then having to pay and, you know, recover your assets as well. So there was a mixture of things that were used to rebuild the city.
Did they rebuild in the same way in the sense that they were houses and buildings were rebuilt in the same places, or did they use it as an opportunity to kind of reshape London? How different is London after the fire as to how it looked before the fire?
So this is one of the big famous stories about the fire, is these kind of lost plans for this utopian city that could have been. So literally, probably as the fire was still burning, you would find all the polymaths in and around London scribbling down plans for rebuilding the city. And, you know, these plans were submitted to the king by Sir Christopher Wren. Christopher Wren annoyed the Royal Society by submitting the plan to the king before checking with them first. There was another plan by Robert Hooke. There was a plan put forward by John Evelyn. There was a plan, which is one of my favourite ones, by a man called Valentine Knight, and it was literally just straight lines across a page. it's like, oh, I may as well have a go.
Inspiring.
All these plans were put forward and they were considered, but at the end of the day, and this is why the fire courts were so important, London wasn't owned by one person. It was owned by thousands of people. Everyone had a vested interest in their own section of London. So essentially the city was rebuilt largely along the same lines as it had been before, the difference being that there was a bit more space, streets were a little bit wider, and buildings had to be stone or brick. They were not supposed to be wooden anymore. So they were rebuilt in a way to reduce the risk of fire. But we see this legacy of Christopher Wren's plan for London kind of having a life of its own, even. And the historian Michael Hebert, who's a historian of architectural history and cities, has recently put together an article that explored this interesting legacy and how Christopher Wren, when they were looking to rebuild the city after the Blitz, Christopher Wren's face and like resemblance and his vision of a utopian London was on one of the main pamphlets that was about rebuilding London after the Blitz, even though it never happened. So I feel like there are two stories here. There's the real bricks and mortar and rebuilding, but there's also this utopian London idea that began and took hold after the Great Fire as well.
One of the most famous sources for the fire is Samuel Pepys's diary. How much, you know, does Eloise Ariel wanted to know, does his diary add much to our understanding of the way of the fire itself and how it spread, other than how to bury cheese in your back garden?
Cheese and wine. We always forget the wine. He buried wine as well. Before anyone thinks, oh, did he recover it? No evidence in his diary of him actually retrieving this. I'm sure he did though. So, yes, his diary is amazing. It's a brilliant account of what happened during the Great Fire, and it really does help in terms of understanding how it spread. And we're really lucky when it comes to this period in time, because there were quite a few diarists and accounts of what was going on, most of them written by men. Frustratingly, I'd love to have more accounts that are written by women that give their perspective. But in any case, we do have these accounts. One thing that I always find really interesting about Samuel Pepys during the Great Fire of London is he writes this incredible account of what's going on, of how he's, you know, moving his goods and to a house all the way out in, you know, far away as Bethnal Green. And he, but there's no evidence of him actually, you know, getting down and dirty and actually helping put out the fire. He's just commenting on this whole thing. So I think he, to be honest, he was probably like a lot of people. He was really, you know, worried about his own stuff. He was sleep deprived. So you do get this sense that, well, he does say that he forgets what day it is. And he did do one key thing at the beginning of the fire, which was tell the king that the fire was going on. And he feels that he's the first person to tell him, but I'm pretty sure the king knew already. But in any case, it doesn't really matter. He did go and he instructed, he went back into the city to, you know, carry out certain instructions. But after that point, he's kind of looking after number one. But, you know, from his account, we get the human side of things. So we get stories of women in the streets after the Great Fire, putting big wads of sugar into barrels of beer that they found and drinking them. You get the descriptions of pigeons having their wings scorched. You get this description of a cat having its fur singed. So all of these human things we're really lucky to have from his diary.
I mean, you've written a book on the topic. I mean, what other sources are there that are kind of useful to understanding more about the fire?
Well, the fire court is amazing, because the fire court records, because you can go into so many different cases. There's one family that I write about in my book. Well, I follow their story through the Great Plague and the Great Fire and the Anglo-Dutch Wars. And they're called the Vandermarsch family, and they're a family of Dutch immigrants that had been naturalised in 1661, I think. It might have been 1662. But in any case, they'd been naturalised. So they were, you know, they were Londoners. But because they were foreign born, despite being a very wealthy family, the head of the family, John or Johann Vandermarsch, would never have been able to be an alderman, but anyone else in his position would have had that opportunity. So you, from the fire courts, there are amazing records of what happened to that family during the Great Fire. He paid basically for people to help put out the fire. He was handing out £50, people to help put out the fire around his home and on his street, which was Lime Street. He lost most of his house in the end. But when you get to the fire courts, you have neighbours saying, yes, he deserves to have this plot of land back again because he helped put out the fire. So he's there faced with xenophobia because he's Dutch born and there's lots of that going on at the time. But then equally, neighbours on the ground are saying, no, he's a good Dutch person. He's okay to have his house back. So it's a really complex picture that you get from looking at the fire court records. Other records, William Tazwell, who I mentioned was a schoolboy at the time, wrote a memoir when he was a man much later on, and described his journey through the Great Fire and how he was tackling the fire with his school friends to the east of the city. John Evelyn's accounts are really good as well. But then you find in the state records, this is where you get the women coming into the picture a bit more. You find in the state records petitions and people saying about things that they'd lost, and you get these female accounts. But then there are also accounts from families, letters that are going back and forth as well, describing the loss that they've encountered as a result.
Of course, you know, it wouldn't have just been it's not just the structures that were destroyed, it was the actual, all the contents of people's homes and things like that. How did they go about replacing that type of thing?
It was, yeah, I mean, that was hard. So some, it was hard for people, and how they replaced it, I in all honesty, I don't know. They would have replaced it piecemeal and as much as they can. But what you find are these accounts of people. One man, I think his name's Dr. Denton, writes how his wife, who'd owned a house within the city of London, which had been a big part of their income, and the house had been destroyed, she was just in floods of tears the whole time. She'd kind of recover herself for a little bit and then would be in floods of tears again, because the prospect of rebuilding and, you know, going without crucial income for a long period of time was just overwhelming for some people. So yeah, you're right. The buildings were lost, people's possessions were lost, but also the other thing that I think is often overlooked is the fact that people's souls were crushed as well. And this was an event that really stayed with people for a long time afterwards, if not their whole life.
And is there kind of any evidence or stories of Charles II sort of visiting any of the sort of stricken parts of London? You know, you mentioned the Blitz earlier, and we know obviously that the royal family kind of looked at the damage, and, you know, that's quite common in modern history. Did anything like that happen back then?
Yeah, so Charles made sure that he was seen. Charles and his brother made sure that they were seen and out and active, trying to save the city as much as they could. I mean, this was for two reasons. Firstly, it was a necessity that, you know, the city was on fire, and they kind of everybody had to do what they could to save this city. But secondly, it was political too. So there had been a lot of uncomfortableness, if that's a word. Unease is probably a better word, at the fact that the royal court had fled London during the Great Plague. So it was really important politically for the king to be seen trying to fight for his capital city. And we see that when the London Gazette, which was the main newspaper at the time, when the London Gazette comes back into print a couple of weeks after the Great Fire, we see that it's really emphasising the role that the king and the Duke of York played in uplifting people's spirits, and then also actively fighting the fire as well.
Just to kind of conclude, I guess, how different would London be if the Great Fire hadn't happened? You know, what was its legacy?
It's almost an impossible question to ask, because it means that we'd have to go into a counterfactual and kind of imagine what may or may not have happened in the 18th century, in the 19th century, the 20th century. So we don't know how different. I mean, obviously, lots of historic buildings were destroyed. Would there have been movements without the Great Fire of London to ensure that buildings were built in non-combustible materials? Probably, actually. There's evidence that stone and brick buildings were being put in place before the Great Fire anyway. If you look to any of the grand houses that were kind of on the Strand and to the west of the metropolis of London, not the city of London, they were all made out of brick and, you know, sustainable materials like that. And there were a few houses and spaces in London, the city of London, that were doing the same. So maybe that would have happened, and maybe it would have happened a little bit more slowly. I'm not sure. We probably would still have Baynard's Castle, I imagine. I imagine that would have still been around and probably still been a really important historic building that people visited even today, perhaps. So, yeah, I mean, we don't know. For me, the biggest legacy of the Great Fire of London is the psychological one for the people that experienced it. And Pepys was saying how he had nightmares about the Great Fire months afterwards. And another account from a man said that he didn't think the memory of this terrible event would ever leave him throughout his whole life. And I think that's where the real story is, with the people that experienced it.
That was Rebecca Radil. Rebecca's book, 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire, was published in 2016 by Thomas Dunn Books. You can find a link to that in our show notes. And you can also find plenty more on the Great Fire of London at our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow for an episode on a pioneer of vaccination.